This is the Financial Sense News Hour. Now, here's the Financial Sense News Team, Jim Poplava and John Loeffler.
A drumbeat is sounding among the global elites. The signs of a coming financial crisis, one exponentially bigger than the last, was unmistakable. This time, the elites have an audacious plan to protect themselves from the fallout, hoarding cash now, and locking down the global financial system when the crisis hits. And that's the theme and topic of a new book called The Road to Ruin, The Global Elite's Secret Plan for the Next Financial Crisis by author James Rickert, who joins me on the program now. Jim, let's begin. You talk about in your book about Felix Sumrall. Explain to our listeners who he was and why his views were so prescient and important to the world we live in today.
Felix Sumrall, I describe him in the book as possibly the greatest economist of the 20th century, although I make the point that no one's ever heard of him, or at least very few have heard of him, and indeed, I had not heard of him until about 2 years ago. A friend of mine, well, two friends, Ronnie Stefeli and Mark Velik, who live in Vienna, called his work to my attention. Sumrall was born in the late 19th century, died in 1959, so lived through the first half of the 20th century. He went to the University of Vienna. He was a classmate of Joseph Schumpeter. He was a student of Eugen von Böhm-Bawerk, who was one of the founders of the Austrian School of Economics, so completely immersed in that original Austrian school that was coming out of the University of Vienna. But he was not a strict Austrian later in his career. He did get a PhD in economics, but he was really a practitioner. He was a wealth manager. He moved to Zurich a little bit after World War I and remained there the rest of his life. He was really a wealth manager and a private banker. So that's kind of the quick background. But the reason I picked up on his work, his nickname was the Raven of Zurich. And indeed, that was the name of his memoir, the book I cite in my book, The Road to Ruin. And by the way, great book, but I'll just warn anyone who's interested in reading it. It has been out of print in English and German for over 30 years. You can get copies on Amazon, you know, used copies, obviously, but they run anywhere from $900 to $5,000 a copy. So it's definitely a rare item, but I highly recommend a reading, but I'll just warn listeners that it's a very expensive thing if they want to locate a copy. I keep mine under lock and key. But his memoir is called The Raven of Zurich. The raven in mythology and in the Bible and the Old Testament is a symbol of prophecy. So it really refers to his ability to see events in advance. And the question is, how do you do that? And his technique is very similar to techniques that I and others have been using more recently, specifically Bayesian statistics and behavioral psychology. Now, he didn't call it Bayesian statistics. You know, he didn't say I'm using Bayes' rule. But when you look at what he did and how he did it, that was exactly right. And the one conversation in particular that includes his memoir that I quote in the book, he was talking to the brother of King George V 2 weeks before World War I. So this is the middle of July 1914. And the king's brother had just come from a meeting with the Kaiser and assured Sumrall and others that there would be no war between Germany and England. And he said, when I heard that, I immediately sold all my clients' assets, converted them to gold, and put the gold in Norway and Switzerland. In other words, he knew that the elites are often the last to know. We invest so much power and authority and respect in our leaders and our elites and our political leaders. And of course, then they were royal families. Today we have elected officials. But the point being, the reality is they're often using the wrong models. They're often the last to know. They live in a bubble. By the way, no better example of that than the run-up to our recent presidential election when polls, pundits, betting odds, elite opinion, everywhere you looked, said the election was over, Clinton had already won, and of course, it turned out not to be the case. I was out for a week before the election doing a series of interviews in which I said that Trump would win, but when I said Trump would win, I don't just make claims, I explain my method, but my method was the same one that Felix Sumrall was using. So I use him as an example of how, even in the absence of formal mathematical models, which I do use, if you have the correct understanding of processes, you can get very, very good forecasting results. And just to sum up, Jim, the way I would put it, it's not so much that he or I or anyone else has a crystal ball. There's no magic in it. You're not looking into the future. The point is the future is here today. The future is already embedded in today's data. You just have to know where to look for it, and you have to understand the process. It's like if I have a row of dominoes, and I knock over the first domino, and they're falling, and I say, Jim, what's going to happen to the last domino? And you say, it's going to fall. and then boom, it falls. I mean, did you have a crystal ball? No, you knew the facts that all the dominoes were lined up. You understood enough about physics to see the momentum was going, the last domino was going to fall. So you can often forecast the last domino falling before it falls just by understanding the process. That's what he did. That's what I try to do. And that's what I describe for readers in the book.
You know, one thing that we've seen, Jim, and includes even forecasting this election, Wall Street, the Fed, academics, forecasts, they make a lot of forecasts on where the economy is going, the unemployment rate, the inflation rate. And the vast majority of the time, they're wrong. Something is wrong with the system, because we can think of the Federal Reserve. This year, they were supposed to raise rates 4 times. It's lucky if they even go once. What is behind these forecasts that they go awry so many times? Are they looking at the wrong data, or is it really that their models are flawed?
It's really the latter. It's a great question, Jim. And first of all, I know or interacted with a lot of the people you're describing, so I've met a number of Board of Governors of the Federal Reserve System and some regional Reserve Bank presidents and the head of monetary research and officials at the IMF. So, you know, I was partners with 2 Nobel Prize winners and a lot of other PhD economists back in my days in long-term capital management. So I've had a lot of interactions with exactly the people we're talking about. And they're not dumb. I mean, they're brilliant. You know, they have 160, 165 IQs. I don't think they have malintent. And their data is fine. They look at the same data you and I look at. The difference is the models. If you have the wrong model, you're going to get the wrong result every single time. And that's what they do. In fact, there are behavioral and sociological studies show that economists, academic economists, and professional economists actually do worse than monkeys. And when I say that, it's not to be insulting, because a monkey knows nothing, but given a binary choice, so market up or down, economy, you know, stronger, weaker, you know, given a set of binary choices, a monkey will guess or throw darts and be right half the time and wrong half the time. Economists are actually wrong more than half the time, more than a random outcome. And that's because a number of factors. One, the one we mentioned, which is the models are wrong, and I can talk about that in a second. But the other one is a herding phenomenon, which is an economist, they would rather be wrong together than to take a chance on being out of the consensus, even if it meant you could be right. And again, I think that the Trump-Clinton forecasting was a perfect example. We don't have to go to politics. We can talk about economics as well. But the point is, it was just groupthink. If everyone was saying Hillary was going to win, and you said Hillary was going to win, you ended up being wrong, but it felt good to be in the group. Whereas if you were one of the people, you know, as I was, saying that Trump was going to win, boy, was that lonely. I mean, it feels good now because it's over, and that forecast was correct, but when I was doing it over the past month or so, I mean, you were getting laughed at, you were getting raised eyebrows, people were just, you know, aghast that you would even say that. And the same is true in economics. If you want to make a contrary forecast or something that's not in the consensus, just be prepared for a lot of ridicule. So that explains part of the behavior, but what is it about the models that is so wrong? The main thing is they use what are called equilibrium models, the technical name, dynamic, stochastic, general equilibrium models. They assume that the economy is like a clock or maybe a top that's spinning. And, you know, if it gets a little bit out of line, all you do is apply policy and get it back into line. Just tweak it a little bit. A good metaphor actually is a thermostat in your house. You know, the house is too cold, you dial up the thermostat, it warms up. If the house is too warm, you dial it down, it cools off a little bit. It's linear, it's reversible, very easy to control. That's how they think about the economy. If the economy is too slow, you know, cut rates, that's like dialing the thermostat up and so on. In fact, the economy is not an equilibrium system. It's a complex system. And we could do a 1-hour lecture or a 5-hour lecture on complexity theory, but suffice to say that the evidence is very good that the capital markets are not only a complex system, but probably one of the best examples of a complex system. Complex systems behave in completely different ways than equilibrium systems. For one thing, they have what are called emergent properties. That's the so-called black swan. I don't really like the term black swan because it's a metaphor and it's sort of content-free, and people throw the word black swan around and don't really understand, you know, the origins of it or what they're describing. But technically, this is what a physicist would call a phase transition or an emergent property, where basically the system changes radically, almost in an unforeseeable way, or an unpredictable way, and whatever comes out of it was completely unforeseen, not something that you could infer from perfect knowledge of all the elements of the system. So it's like an earthquake or an avalanche. You can look at a snowfield on the side of a mountain. You can be pretty sure that it's unstable and it's going to fall down, but you don't know exactly when. You don't know how big it'll get before it collapses. Same thing with an earthquake. You can identify a seismic zone and look at history and take readings and have a strong sense that there's going to be a massive earthquake, but you don't know exactly when. Well, capital markets are the same way, and major drawdowns and reversals, price spikes, these are just either smaller or larger earthquakes that can be diagnosed, but again, the timing is always a little bit uncertain. That's very different than an equilibrium system. You know, every year the Federal Reserve does a one-year forward forecast. So let's go all the way back to the beginning of this recovery, 2009. They had a forecast for 2010. In 2010, they had a forecast for 2011. So on, all the way up until today. They have been wrong by orders of magnitude 8 years in a row. Not a little bit. I mean, if they said 3%, it came in at 3.1 or 2.9, I would say, nice going. That's awesome. But no, they say 3%, it comes in at, you know, 2.2. And then they lower it to 2.8, and it comes in at 1.7. I mean, these are big misses in GDP world. And same thing with a number of other metrics, not just the Fed. We don't have to pick on the Fed. Same is true with the IMF. Same is true with Wall Street. Well, if you're wrong 8 years in a row, you're probably going to be wrong the ninth year in a row. Because, like I say, it's not because you're dumb. It's because you're using the wrong models. So what I try to do is, in the book, and I describe this for the readers, is first of all, point out what's wrong with the models. And Jim, one very important point. As I said earlier, I don't just make claims and I don't just throw criticism around. If I criticize the model, I'll give you, and I do this in the book, the exact reasons, the exact diagnosis, you know, some of the math. It's not a whole lot of math in the book, but there's a little bit just to illustrate a few points. You know, people can skip over it if you like. And if I make a claim about why something works on the affirmative, again, I'll give the reasons for that. So kind of dissect these models that don't work, lay out some models that do work, give concrete examples for the reader, and I think, you know, it doesn't solve all the problems of the world, but you can be a lot more confident going forward knowing how the system actually works.
You know, one of the things you talk about in your book is this next crisis. In the last crisis, Jim, we saw authorities, whether it was the Fed or it was the government, take extraordinary measures to contain it. And in many ways, they got high marks for stemming the crisis. Here's the question. Did they stem the crisis or merely postpone it?
More the latter. The technical word I would use is they truncated the crisis. So again, going back to our domino example, I said that you can, you know, if a row of dominoes starts falling, you can forecast that the last domino will fall before it happens because you see the physics. But what if I drop a steel curtain between two dominoes? So one domino hits the steel curtain and the next domino doesn't fall because that curtain was dropped in between them. That's what the Fed did. They truncated a process. But in doing so, they did not allow the full release of the energy, and that's sitting there waiting for the next time. So just to give the timeline I use in the book, Jim, I actually have three crises I describe. The first one is 1998, the second one 10 years later in 2008, almost 10 years to the day, and the third one I do a hypothetical crisis in 2018 just to keep up the 10-year tempo, but I make the point that it could be 2018, it could be 2019, it could be tomorrow. Don't put your feet up and feel relaxed for the next 2 years because it could actually be tomorrow. So the 1998 crisis, that's not as well known as what happened in 2008, but that was the Russian default, global liquidity crisis, the collapse of long-term capital management, the hedge fund that threatened to take down all the Wall Street banks. I was the negotiator. I was the lawyer for long-term capital. I negotiated that bailout. I had a front row seat. I was in the room with the Fed and the Treasury and others when that deal happened. And we were just hours away from closing every stock and bond market in the world. Non-exaggeration, Alan Greenspan and the Secretary of the Treasury at the time, Bob Rubin, both testified to that effect. We actually, you know, we got the bailout done. We got the money in, and the world didn't come to an end. And the Fed cut interest rates once on September 29th, cut them again 2 weeks later, not at a scheduled FOMC meeting, but at an emergency Fed meeting, which they had the power to do. By the way, that was the last time the Fed ever acted between meetings, but then it took two rate cuts to put out that fire. So things kind of came in for a soft landing, but we were just hours away from collapsing the entire system. In 2008, same thing. We were days away from the sequential collapse of every major bank in the world. We'd already seen Bear Stearns fail in March 2008. Fannie Mae and Freddie Mac failed in June and July 2008. Lehman Brothers failed in September 2008. Morgan Stanley was a couple of days away. Then it would have been Goldman Sachs, Citibank, Bank of America, JP Morgan. They all would have collapsed. These are like the dominoes that I described. But the Fed intervened and truncated that process. How did they do it? Well, we know, you know, that they printed $4 trillion of money, but it was much, much bigger than that. They did $10 trillion of swaps with the currency swaps with the European Central Bank. And the reason for that was the European banks made loans in dollars. They had to fund them in dollars, so they had dollar liabilities. A lot of those dollar liabilities were bank CDs and IOUs and commercial paper held by U.S. money market funds. So you had a financial panic in the U.S. U.S. investors were taking their money out of money market funds. The money market funds could not roll over or reinvest in the European bank commercial paper, so the European banks had a dollar liquidity crisis. They turned to their central bank, the European Central Bank, for liquidity, because that's central banks are supposed to be the lender of last resort, but there was a problem. The European Central Bank can print euros, but it can't print dollars. Where was it going to get the dollars it needed? So what happened was the European Central Bank printed up tens of trillions of euros. The Fed printed up tens of trillions of dollars. They swapped them. The Federal Reserve actually got the euros. The European Central Bank got the dollars and then used those to bail out the banking system. By the way, this was not known at the time. It came out a few years later because of Dodd-Frank and some congressional hearings, but that was what they did. They also guaranteed every bank deposit in America, regardless of size. Now, of course, we had FDIC insurance up to $250,000 at the time, but they said, hey, if you're a car dealer or a businessman, you got $1 million in the bank because that's your working capital. That was guaranteed. They guaranteed every money market fund in America. They had no legal obligation to do so. They did just to stem the panic. But this is like, Jim, the difference between a man-made system like capital markets and a natural system, like, let's say, an earthquake or a seismic zone, the math and the complexity dynamics are the same. But the difference is you cannot truncate a natural collapse. So when you have an earthquake, you cannot stop the earthquake in the middle of the earthquake. If an earthquake starts, it's going to play itself out. You can't stop it. But imagine if you could. Imagine hypothetically you could stop an earthquake in the middle. Well, an earthquake is just the release of energy. If you could stop it, it wouldn't really solve anything. That energy would be unreleased, but it would just be sitting there building up until the next earthquake, which would be even bigger. Over to capital markets. So the Fed stopped the earthquake. They dropped the steel curtain between the two dominoes, as I described. They truncated the natural collapse, but they didn't solve anything. That energy is waiting there to be released in the next financial crisis. So here's the point. In 1998, Wall Street bailed out the hedge fund. In 2008, the central banks bailed out Wall Street. In 2018, if not sooner, who's going to bail out the central banks? Each bailout gets bigger than the one before. Each collapse gets bigger than the one before. The energy that's not released just gets built up. That's why you have bigger earthquakes every time. And the answer is that there's only one clean balance sheet left in the world. There's only one institution in the world bigger than the central banks that can offer the next bailout. That's the IMF, the International Monetary Fund. They're only levered 3-1. By the way, the Federal Reserve is levered 113-1, but the IMF is levered about 3-1. They can print money. It's not dollars. It's not euros. It's world money. They have a funny name for it. It's called Special Drawing Rights, or SDRs, but it's just world money. It comes off a printing press at the IMF, just like dollars or euros, and that's what they're going to do. But that's going to mark the end of the dollar as the benchmark global reserve currency. That will be, from then on, it'll be the SDR. We'll still have dollars. You and I will have dollars, but it'll be kind of walking around money in the U.S. It won't be the global benchmark.
Governments have moved on various fronts from that crisis, Jim, to regulate the financial system. We got Dodd-Frank. They were trying to make the system safer. You talk in your book about something called G-Sci-Fi. Explain the meaning and its significance.
Sure. G-Sci-Fi, or I think they pronounce it SIFI, S-I-F-I, but you're right, G-Sci-Fi. SIFI stands for Systemically Important Financial Institution. That's just a geeky name for too big to fail. That's what that means. G just means global. Each country has a list of SIFIs or SIBs, SIBs, systemically important banks. But the systemically important financial institutions, the SIFIs, there's sort of an A list of global SIFIs. And it's the names you would be most familiar with. It's Goldman Sachs, HSBC, JP Morgan, UBS, Deutsche Bank, et cetera. These banks are officially too big to fail. But the reason they created this list, this is all done, by the way, by the G20, the group of 20 countries, the largest developed and developing economies in the world. And the G20 has evolved into a de facto board of directors for the world, at least the world economy. They operate through institutions such as the IMF, the United Nations, the OECD, the Organization for Economic Cooperation and Development. They're pursuing an agenda of world money, which is the SDR that I just mentioned, world taxation, world regulation, and ultimately de facto world government. And I know that sounds like some kind of, you know, deep, dark black helicopter conspiracy, but it's all in the book with references. Again, I never make these claims without backing it up with specific working papers, releases from official sources, not some fringe website, but this is, you know, the G20 final communique from the Brisbane summit in Australia in November 2014 has the bail-in plan. It's there. It's one of the attachments to the final communique. You have to be a geek like me to actually go ahead and read it. But when you read it, you'll find the blueprint. The bail-in is right there. So what they're going to do in the next financial crisis, when these G-SIFIs, these global too-big-to-fail banks, are under stress, I made the point that the last two times, 1998 and 2008, they all got bailed out. The next time, they're not going to get bailed out with taxpayer money because the leaders know that's too unpopular. There's going to be a bail-in. And a bail-in is different. Your money is still at risk, but in a different way. So what a bail-in is, you basically take over the institution and you apportion the losses among depositors, stockholders, and bondholders, and perhaps trading counterparts as well. Stockholders should expect nothing. Their stock will be wiped out. Bondholders should expect haircuts, meaning they won't get 100 cents on the dollar. They might get 80 cents or they might get 30 cents, depending on the size of the hole on the balance sheet. And depositors should expect to lose their money over the insured amount. So if insurance is, say, 100,000 euros or $250,000, whatever it is, they'll probably protect that much, but anything above that, that money will be taken from you. It will be converted into equity in a bad bank, and you know, good luck collecting on that. It might take 10 years or more to unwind those assets. So, but that's the plan. That's if all goes well. They'll take your money, anything in excess of the insured amount, wipe out your stock, wipe out your bonds. They'll take that if all goes well. If it's worse than that, and in my estimation, it will be, because as I said earlier, each crisis is bigger and more dangerous than the one before, and the ability to bail out or, you know, ride to the rescue of central bank printed money keeps diminishing because they never normalize their balance sheets after the last crisis, then what they're going to do is actually lock down the system. Because it's going to take the IMF, you know, 3 to 6 months at a minimum to issue these SDRs. This is not a nimble institution. I mean, even working it flat out, you know, they have to get the leaders together, have to get the executive committee together, have to agree on a plan, come up with a consensus, make a vote, et cetera, et cetera. All that takes time. But in the meantime, they're going to lock down the system. They're going to close the banks, close exchanges, reprogram ATMs so maybe you can get, you know, $300 a day for gas and groceries, but no more than that. And they'll just look at you and say, why do you need more than that? You know, for, you know, gas and groceries. We'll get back to you about the rest of your savings. You can't have it right now. You know, and a simpler way to explain it, Jim, is that in 1998, everybody wanted their money back and the banks printed it up and gave it to them. In 2008, everybody wanted their money back and the banks printed it up and gave it to them. In the next crisis, 2018, if not sooner, everybody's going to want their money back, but they're not going to give it to you. Instead of printing up the money and giving it to you, they're going to lock down the system and say you can't have it until further notice, and further notice is going to involve, as I say, bail-in rules and printing SDRs, and that will be highly inflationary, and basically your wealth will be wiped out either through freezes, confiscation, or inflation.
Do you see this as a process that unfolds? Because usually, whether it's Brexit or even the last crisis, and we saw this with Greenspan in the 90s, Greenspan and Bernanke and Yellen, they would just print money. Are you seeing this next crisis, Jim, is going to be so large, there just won't be the credibility to print the money and the system hold together that they'll need to lock it down?
That's exactly right. And just to illustrate that, so in 2008, the Federal Reserve's balance sheet was $800 billion. By 2015, it had grown to $4.2 trillion. In other words, they printed $3.4 trillion of new money. And, of course, we all know what happened to interest rates. They took them to zero and sat on them and kept them there. Okay, went up, they had lift off a year ago, 25 basis points, but that's it. So if somehow the Fed had done that and solved the crisis or rescued the system and had normalized everything, if they had taken their balance sheet back down to $800 billion or maybe even, say, a trillion, and if interest rates had gone up to, you know, 2.25%, 2.5%, so they had some dry powder for the next recession, I would be the first one to congratulate them. I would say, nice going, guys. You know, you saved the world by expanding your balance sheet and cutting rates, and then you normalized everything. You got your balance sheet back to normal. You got interest rates back to normal. You're ready for the next crisis. But that's not what happened. They expanded the balance sheet, cut rates, but they never normalized it. The balance sheet is still about $4 trillion. Interest rates are still close to zero. What are they going to do if this panic arrives tomorrow, which it could? They have no more capacity to grow the balance sheet without destroying confidence. I mean, legally they could, and you know, you run into modern monetary theorists, people like Paul McCulley and Stephanie Kelton and Richard Duncan and others who believe that there's, you know, no limit on what the Fed can do. But I think that's incorrect. There may not be a legal limit, but there's an invisible confidence limit. There comes a time when you've destroyed confidence. People just say, hey, I'm out of here. I don't know what's going on. I don't get this, but, you know, get me out of dollars. Get me into gold, silver, land, fine art, hard assets, natural resources, private equity, something other than this crazy dollar system. And I think the central banks know that. And even if they don't, even if they're a little bit oblivious to the confidence boundary, there's a political ceiling. The politicians are not going to stand for it. So they're out of bullets. They're at the limit of what they can do. And they're going to have to turn to the IMF in the next crisis because that's the only source of liquidity that has not been tapped out.
So as we take a look at, you know, you describe something in your book called ICE 9, which is basically the power elite's response to the crisis of locking down this system. You refer to examples like in Cyprus, the Greek sovereign crisis. And, you know, one of the problems is because the system is leveraged, the problem is when everybody panics and wants their cash. And they're moving towards a war on cash. And it's amazing because you refer to a book, The Curse of Cash by Kenneth Rogoff, which I just read. You're advocating, Jim, keeping some cash and some gold. But what about the issue and what about the possibility that the U.S. government, just like Roosevelt in 1933, confiscates gold? Then what do you do?
Well, they could try. A couple things I would point out. Number one, let's define the word confiscate, because we do have the Fifth Amendment. The Fifth Amendment prohibits the taking of property without just compensation. So how did Roosevelt do that exactly in 1933? Well, he ordered all the gold to be handed over by executive order. There was no act of Congress. But he did pay you $20 an ounce. Technically, it was $20.67 an ounce. So he did pay $20 an ounce. But he knew that he was going to raise the price of gold, which isn't, of course, really raising the price of gold. It's devaluing the dollar to, it ended up being $35 an ounce. So he did not want gold holders to profit from that. So he collected the gold at $20 an ounce and then raised the price to $35 an ounce and kept the profit for the government. So I consider that a form of confiscation because it was all part of a plan. And he deprived gold holders of their rightful profit between the difference between $20 and $35. That was a 75% price increase, by the way, in the middle of the longest period of deflation in U.S. history. So at least to the extent of the $15, that was a confiscation because Roosevelt knew he was going to do it. But there were two things that were true. Number one, technically, he did not violate the Fifth Amendment because he did give you the $20, which was the price at the time. And two, we were on a gold standard, so that's what justified the $20 price. It wasn't a market price. It was a fiat price. That was the law. You know, the dollar was defined as one, you know, 20th of an ounce of gold. So he was obeying the Constitution only in the letter of the law, but not the spirit of the law. The difference today, Jim, is that there is no gold standard. Gold goes with the market. So if we even got close to a point, close to the point where the government would have to confiscate the gold, most of the profits would be there already. You would have the profits. They're not going to take it for zero. That's unconstitutional. I mean, maybe if we get to martial law and, you know, state of emergency or state of siege or something, I mean, I can't rule anything out. But at least under the Constitution, they can't take it. They have to pay you dollars. And in the absence of a gold standard, the circumstances under which they would pay you, the gold would already be $10,000 an ounce.
Okay, so you're saying by the time they get around to confiscating it, the appreciation or the protection of holding that gold during that period of time would protect you. But what if, Jim, something else happens? Like Roosevelt, he confiscated, gave everybody $20, and they revalued it to $35. What if gold is at $10,000 and they revalue it to $20?
When Roosevelt took it at $20, it couldn't be any other price. We were on a gold standard. But if the government has it in mind to revalue gold to $20,000, the market's going to front run the government. The thing is, if they ordered everyone to hand in the gold at $10,000, what do you think the price of gold would do? It would go to $20,000.
So let's go and talk about something that could maybe cause a possible crisis. One is the structure of the derivative market today. The big banks, have gotten bigger since the financial crisis. JP Morgan's bigger, Citibank's bigger, Bank of America, they're all bigger today. So this idea that they're too big to fail still remains in place. But one of the big risks out there is the derivative book and the leverage, because the banks would argue, as you know, Jim, that, oh, well, it's really not the notional value. By the time you net out our positions, it really isn't that big. But you know, in a financial crisis, it's the gross notional value of that derivative book that really counts. And in 2008, what we saw is many of those banks, or in the case of insurance company AIG, could not deliver on their commitments.
That is exactly right. And I discussed this in The Road to Ruin in some detail, but there are two aspects of that, Jim. One, the one you mentioned, and one other one that I'll get to in a second. But in terms of the one you mentioned, so let's imagine you're a bank and you've got a $1 billion swap trade that's a synthetic 10-year note. So you're receiving fixed, you're paying floating, and you have that on with some other bank, you know, maybe Goldman Sachs. And you've hedged that with me. I'm a bank too. And you put a $1 billion trade on with me, except you're going to be paying fixed and receiving floating. And you've got $2 billion of gross notional value in synthetic 10-year notes in the form of swaps, and just to make a little spread, you know, between the two. And that's fine when everything's normal, although the leverage is enormous. When you go to calculate your risk, when you go to the regulators, and the regulator says, do you have enough capital? You say, well, yeah, because I've got this big short position with Jim Rickard's bank, and I got this big long position with Goldman Sachs, and they net out, and my risk is quite small. You know, the regulator says, fine, you have enough capital, and they go away. But if I'm the one going broke, I'm the one going bankrupt, I don't owe you the spread. I owe you the whole $1 billion. In other words, if I go away and renege on my swap agreement with you, all of a sudden you go from a net position to $1 billion long. You're going to run out into the market and try to dump that position and short it to cover your exposure. So that's how a net exposure, when everything's calm, instantaneously morphs into a gross exposure when there's a financial panic underway. That's exactly what happened with AIG. It's exactly what happened with long-term capital management. In a panic, no one's concerned about their net exposure on their own books. They're concerned about their gross exposure to their counterparties. Well, that's a very big deal. That's like night and day, and yet we're running the risk management system and the regulatory capital system on the basis of, you know, net value at risk, where the longs and shorts offset each other. So that's just insanity. But the other thing is that, going back to the earlier discussion of complexity and complexity theories and complex dynamics, one of the things that you learn when you study these systems and you look at what's called the degree distribution, so what is the worst thing that can happen, or what are, you know, small events, large events, mega events that involve risk or loss as a function of frequency. So how often do big events happen, et cetera. So that degree distribution of size and frequency has a curve associated with it that grows exponentially as the system scales up. So what that means in plain English is, if you double the system, you don't double the risk. You probably increase it by a factor of 10. And if you, you know, increase the system by 5, you don't increase the risk by 5, you probably increase it by a factor of 50. In other words, risk is an exponential function of scale. So we've been growing the scale larger and larger. You're exactly right. Everything that was too big to fail in 2008 is bigger today. The 5 largest banks are absolutely bigger. They have a larger percentage of the total banking assets. Their derivatives books are much larger. We'll take that, which is just data, and combine it with complexity theory, which says that risk is an exponential function of scale. You can see that the risk in the system is unprecedented. It's way beyond what it was in 2008. And we could barely hang on then. What's going to happen the next time? So this is really the point, that through misapprehension of the statistical properties of risk, bad modeling, recklessness, greed, because, you know, greed plays a role, because these bad models allow the bankers to pay themselves bigger bonuses until it all falls apart, and then they dump it on the taxpayers, or maybe under the bail-in rules, dump it on the depositors, but they will never give the money back that they extracted from the system, making big bonuses, acting in a reckless way. But basically, putting all that together, we have a bigger, more dangerous, more risky system, reduced capacity to deal with it. And as they say, when the next crisis comes, and it will come soon, you can be certain of that, they're going to have to turn to the IMF, and that's the end of the dollar. So my advice for investors is, have some, not all, I don't recommend 100%, but have some allocation to hard assets such as gold, silver, fine art, income-producing land, maybe private equity alternatives, things other than your traditional stock and bond portfolio.
In your book, you talk about Naomi Klein's book, Shock Doctrine, where the elites would use a natural or financial disaster that creates fear to advance their new world order, because you talk about really where ultimately they want to go. And we've heard about this with Bush number one, the new world order. They want to go to one money, one world, one order. And in order to do that, they're also going to need a global tax system. And maybe the way they do that is through their BIP system, BEPS. And they're using climate change as a platform to implement that hidden agenda.
Well, Jim, I discuss all of that in the book, and you're exactly right. And the shock doctrine is the idea basically is that the elites always have an agenda, but they know that their agenda is unpopular. And we still live in democracies, and as we saw the other day with the election of Donald Trump. So democracy still works in its own way. So the elites have to say, well, okay, we have an unpopular agenda. We're operating in democratic spheres. How do we advance the agenda when we know that people don't really support it? And one of the ways to do it is to either wait for a panic, and they do come along, whether it's 9/11 or 2008 or 1998. There are many, many examples, but wait for a panic. And then when everyone's scared and fearful, roll out the agenda, and they'll be so grateful that you have a plan that they'll let you enact the plan, and then you never give it back. This is what I call the ratchet. So you may go 5 or 10, sometimes 15 years without this agenda being advanced, but once it is advanced, it never goes in reverse. You can never get it back again. So whether you manufacture a crisis, such as a war, or just wait for a crisis, because they always come along sooner than later, the elites just take the plan off the shelf, dust it off, you know, get it pushed through very quickly. You know, a good example after 9/11, the Patriot Act. Look, some of the parts of the Patriot Act were necessary. There was really bad information sharing between the CIA and the FBI, and if that had been approved, things might have been a little bit better. So I'm not saying the entire Patriot Act was a scam or a disaster, but parts of it were absolutely from the Treasury Department wish list as part of the war on cash and other things that they wanted to implement, which they knew were not very popular, but they pushed them all through as part of the Patriot Act. And again, same thing in 2008 with Dodd-Frank, and the same thing the next time. So they used the crisis to advance their agenda over the objections of people who, at least in the middle of the crisis, are very fearful and just grateful for any kind of relief. But that, I think, is particularly relevant in the age of Donald Trump, because Trump is anti-elite. He may be a wealthy individual, but he's not a traditional part of the global financial elite, you know, the kind of people who go to Davos and the Aspen Ideas Festival and Jackson Hole and some of these other conclaves around the world. But the elites are still out there. So whereas someone like President Obama, or if Hillary Clinton had won, you know, President Clinton, they definitely are part of this elite that we're talking about, and they would work hand in glove with the elite to advance the agenda. But when you get somebody like Trump, who's not part of it, you have to kind of work around them, you know, because they're not going to embrace your agenda. And one of the ways you do that is by perhaps causing a financial crisis. And then if people don't know any better, they'll buy into any solution that's on offer. And that's how the elites get these things done. But when I say things, we are talking about, in stages, the elimination of cash, basically herding everyone into a digital pen to be led to the slaughter through negative interest rates or confiscation.
You talk about some of the things that have happened since 2008, and as you point out, they truncated the crisis. What we know from 2008, Jim, derivatives are larger today on a larger scale than they were in 2008. The big banks are bigger. There's more risk in the system. You talk in your book about bubbles in themselves may not be bad. If they're not financed with debt, think of the tech bubble in 2000, nobody got hurt. I mean, yes, investors lost money in the stock market, but basically the economy was still there. When you take a look at the 2008 crisis, where we had a real estate bubble, that was different because it was funded by debt. Explain the difference between the two, because some would say, if you look at the stock market today, whether you're looking at cyclically adjusted PE ratios, or if you're looking at the bond market today that has the lowest interest rates in 5,000 years of history, there's a bubble forming there. How would you describe it?
This goes to one of the longest running debates in financial economics, which is, should central banks pop bubbles? That's the question. And the debate, I mean, it's a long-running debate, but the key case study is 1929, well, actually beginning in 1927, 28, and 29, because we had a massive stock market crash in 1929 that led straight to the Great Depression. And this was studied by Milton Friedman and Anna Schwartz in their really a landmark book of monetary history of the United States. Now, the Fed at that time tried to pop a bubble. The Fed actually should have been pursuing easier monetary policies because U.S. growth was so strong and our trade deficits were so large in the late 1920s. We were getting massive gold inflows. This is back when you had a gold standard and discretionary monetary policy side by side. Gold was flowing into the United States from around the rest of the world. Well, under the gold standard, you as a central bank should have eased monetary policy. The idea was actually to allow some inflation that would, over time, make your goods a little bit less competitive. That would help the other guy's exports, hurt your exports, balance the trade, terms of trade would shift in favor of the trading partners. They could then earn some surpluses of their own and get the gold back. So the gold was just a way of keeping score. It moved back and forth among trading partners depending on the terms of trade. So that was the theory. That's actually how it worked in practice. But the Fed didn't follow that. When they should have eased, they tightened. And they tightened because they were trying to pop a stock market bubble and indirectly may have caused, probably did cause the Great Depression. So come all the way forward to the 1990s, and Greenspan was wrestling with this. And he saw that, you know, remember in 1996, he gave that famous speech about irrational exuberance in the stock market. He was worried about it as early as 1996, but he didn't do anything. He didn't raise rates beyond a certain point and try to pop that bubble because he was mindful of the lessons of 1928, 1929. But they took the other view. They said, you know what? It's not our job to pop bubbles. That can be dangerous. But what we'll do is we'll clean up the mess. So once the bubble pops, we'll come along, and if we have to provide some liquidity or, you know, prop up a bank, we'll do what we need to do to make sure the system doesn't spin out of control, but we're not in the business of popping bubbles. So that's what Greenspan did, and it actually worked. The tech bubble did pop in 2000. Now, if you were an investor in tech stocks, you might have lost 100% of your money. The NASDAQ dropped 80% beginning in January 2000. By early 2001, it dropped from over 5,000 to around 2,000. So a bubble did pop. Greenspan didn't cause it. It popped on its own. There were losses to stock investors, but there was no financial panic. It did not severely adversely affect the general economy. So everyone says that proves the case. In other words, Milton Friedman had criticized the Fed for trying to pop a bubble in 1928 and then actually causing the Great Depression. Greenspan said, I'm not going to do it. And sure enough, the bubble popped on its own and we didn't have a recession. So that seemed to prove the case. So in 2007, when there was clearly another bubble, Bernanke took those two lessons to heart. He said, well, the Fed tried to pop a bubble. They caused the Great Depression. Greenspan let a bubble pop on its own and nothing bad happened. So I'm going to let this bubble pop on its own. But Bernanke learned the wrong lesson. And the reason he learned the wrong lesson was that the difference that I point to in the book that you described, Jim, which is that there's a difference between debt-caused bubbles and bubbles just caused by speculation. 2000 was caused by speculation. There wasn't a lot of debt in the system. You know, people were bidding up stocks. Maybe there were some margin accounts, but that was very much a speculative bubble by stock market participants. What happened in 2007 was completely driven by debt. And when the bubble pops, you don't just have a drawdown of prices. You have a massive wave of bad debts. You have contagion. You have bank failures. You have panic. And that's what happened. So now Janet Yellen, now the chairman of the Fed, is trying to internalize all these lessons. And the point I make in the book is she's repeating Bernanke's mistake. She really has not learned the distinction between debt-fueled bubbles and non-debt-fueled bubbles. What we have, once again, is a debt-fueled bubble. This is not a bubble like 2000 that's based on pure speculation. It's a bubble more like 2007 that's based on debt. And when it pops, it's going to, as I say, be bigger and more catastrophic than anything that's ever happened before, and they're going to have to turn to the IMF for liquidity. So, you know, Jim, I hope the listeners enjoy the book. It's The Road to Ruin. It's available for pre-order on Amazon or Barnes & Noble. It'll be out in the bookstore soon, and I really appreciate the opportunity to come on the show and talk to the listeners about it.
Jim, well, listen, thanks for joining us on the program. All the best and success with this new book.
Thank you.
You're listening to the Financial Sense News Hour at financialsense.com. To speak to Jim Poplava or his financial planning team, call us toll-free at 888-486-3939. That's 888-486-3939. We'd be glad to help you plan your customized investment portfolio.
You know, Financial Sense News Hour listeners should remember that our premium members are able to hear the weekday Financial Sense News Hour, featuring interviews with top economic commentators and experts. If you're not a member, here's one of the interviews you missed this week.
In a shock win, at least to the consensus and most of the election forecasting experts, Trump has not only gained the presidency, but Republicans have also now taken both houses of Congress. So the big question I think on the minds of most investors is, what are the implications for the markets and the economy? What does this mean for the future of America and for many of our global trading partners? Joining us on the show today is Jeffrey Sott. He is the chief investment strategist at Raymond James. And Jeff, let's talk about the shock win by Trump. It took most of the forecasters by surprise. The prediction markets were in some cases saying that Hillary was almost guaranteed to win, giving her 82% odds. What are your thoughts on how this shook out, and what do you think the implications are?
I would first say that I don't think you should personalize this election. I mean, it's done. It's in the rearview mirror. I would also comment that not only did they win the White House and Congress, but they basically swept the three branches of government, because the Republicans are going to get to appoint the Supreme Court judges that come up for replacement. You've gotten a spike in uncertainty. You probably have more policy uncertainty right now than you've had since the Bretton Woods Agreement back in 1944. There are going to be policy shifts, but you're not going to know what a Trump U.S. presidential election is going to hold for the rest of the world. It's not going to be clear for a long time, but I suspect that reality is going to be much smaller than many fear. I think Donald Trump will moderate his stance on a lot of things, just like he did in his acceptance speech last night. As far as protectionism goes, here too, I think Trump will roll back his more extreme policy statements. And the fact of the matter is, there's only a handful of economies, most notably Mexico, that are very vulnerable to U.S. protectionism. And I went back in my notes, and in my lifetime, I was born in 1949, there is not an instance that I can find where a Republican in the White House and a Republican House and Senate, where the stock market has not done pretty well. If he does get to cut corporate taxes to 15%, if you run the numbers on that, that could boost S&P earnings by 18%, making the estimates that S&P has for next year more realizable, if you will. Right now, they're at about $132, so that would be bottom-up operating earnings. So I think the country's going to be just fine. I think you're going to get less regulation out there. I think that's going to be a positive for business, and I think that's what has caused this 1,000-point turnaround in the equity markets. I mean, when I got up this morning at 4 a.m. and turned on the TV, I was as shocked as everybody else. And the Dow Jones Industrial Futures were indicating down 800 points. And as I speak, we're up about 200 points on the Dow. So evidently the market thinks something is going to go right here. So I'm still consistent with the belief that the U.S. equity markets are transitioning from an interest rate driven secular bull market to an earnings driven secular bull market. And secular bull markets tend to last 14, 15, 16 years, and they tend to compound at about 16% per year. Let's say we're 8 years into this thing, or just about 8 years into it. It suggests we've got another 6, 7, 8 years left in this before we reach a peak of this secular bull market.
Well, that was the week that was, to coin an old expression. There was a television show back in the 1960s. If for people who are around to remember that, it was a satire show on everything that had gone on politically during the week and in some of the other areas. We had our presidential election this week, and what was expected to be a victory for the Democrats turned out to be an unexpected rout, which has raised a whole series of questions. Welcome back to the Financial Sense News Hour. Jim Poplava, John Loeffler here with you. And it ironically reminded me, Jim, of the elections in Denver, Colorado back in 1994 during the Republican Revolution, because there were a series of amendments to the Colorado Constitution. The polls all said certain ones would fail, like 1 and 2 would fail, 7 would fly through. And in reality, 1 and 2 went through marvelously, and 7 died a horrible death. Just the reverse. And the same questions were being asked back then. But historically, it's hard to compare this election to any other, save possibly for that of Teddy Roosevelt. You know, Teddy Roosevelt wrote in as a Republican. He was populist in the approach that he took. I remember his love of the wilds. He used to talk about the Badlands in South Dakota, saying the Badlands look like Poe sounds, referring to Edgar Allan Poe, the poet, you know. But after a while, he fell in love with it. He was from a wealthy family, very much like Donald Trump, and rode in on a wave of popularity and military activity. Remember the charge up San Juan Hill and his background there, even though later on he would lose at least one of his kids to war in World War I. When the elite didn't support him any longer, he formed the Bull Moose Party to try to run separately. But of course, that didn't succeed either. And now we're in a transition time because people on both sides, you know, Bernie Sanders was a phenomenon as well. It was the same populist movement from the other side of people saying, we are tired of business as usual. We're tired of the double talk and lies coming out of Washington. And they had an agenda. Now, the real interesting question, Jim, is whether or not Mr. Trump can actually pull this off. But if he starts to run government like he would run a business instead of as a politician, you might see some changes. Remember Ronald Reagan? The problem that he came in line with was he would give orders and they would be scuttled a half dozen layers down in the bureaucracy. He's going to have to override that. Perhaps his most famous words from the TV show are, "You're fired." Maybe he needs to use that in Washington as well. But he's facing a series of almost contradictory challenges. Obamacare is a slow motion train wreck as we're watching it. We're just going right through it. Okay, it's not working as we were told, but it just needs some fixing. It's a real first-time disaster, but now it is so entrenched in the medical establishment here, disentangling it. You know, it's not just enough to say, let's repeal this. Whole structures have been reorganized to deal with this, even if it is a failing system. We need to reestablish the military, but we have monetary problems. We have relations to patch up with all sorts of countries that got severed over the Obama administration. And we could go down this giant list of things that need to be fixed. And everybody's watching and saying, we gave you the mandate. Now do something. So,
you know, the thing that really strikes me about this election, and everybody has admitted this has taken everybody by surprise. And we've seen that, John. We saw that earlier in the year with Brexit. The polls favored Great Britain staying within the European Union. And on election day, it turned out to be just the opposite. We saw the markets react almost in a similar fashion, except for with Brexit. The first couple days, we had a big sell-off in the market. Then we had this explosive rally in stocks. If you look at election night eve, as it looked more and more like Trump was going to be the next president, you saw the futures market down close to 800 points on the Dow, only to start out the morning down and then turning positive. But what really struck me is this is in very much in line with what we've seen since the Great Recession, which is the new normal, because you can say nothing about this political campaign has been normal. Here's a guy who has no political experience at all. He has almost the entire media establishment out to get him and was against him. He had a split within his own party. He didn't get the full backing, and yet he brought a lot of congressmen and senators rode in on his coattails because it was widely anticipated that the Democrats were in close call to taking over the Senate and the House. Although nobody thought they would take the House, they thought that there would be major losses. Instead, I think there was only about 5 or 6 seats lost in the House and only 2. But what is more remarkable about this? Here's a guy that did not conduct a regular political campaign. A lot of people said he had no ground game like the Clinton machine. Well, the Trump people would argue our ground game were those rallies where you saw 10, 15, 20, 25,000 people gathered just to see Trump. He used social media very much like Barack Obama did in 2008 and then again in 2012. But it's remarkable, John, single-handedly, he defeated 2 of the most powerful political dynasties in this country, the Bushes and the Clinton. He eviscerated Jeb Bush in the primaries. Jeb Bush started out the primaries with a war chest over $100 million. It meant nothing. I mean, he had 16 opponents, and he decimated the field to become the Republican candidate. And look what he did with Clinton. Clinton literally raised, I forget what amount of money that was spent on this election, but to no avail. So you could say, you know, this is really in line with what we've seen in the new normal.
Well, what is really interesting here to me, having been in broadcasting for about 50 years, is that this was also accomplished by an end run around the traditional gatekeepers in the media, despite all the scorn they poured upon him during the elections. The people still elected him, and his message was able to get out. Now, that's significant for the future because, first of all, they shattered their own credibility as an unbiased or professional source. That was the first thing they did. They would say, in martial arts, it's called overreach. You know, they overreached, whereas before, they always tried to keep this pretense hanging in there. I think that's going to reverse now. I think what we're going to see now is every time Mr. Trump sneezes, there will be a commentary on it, you know, trying to be negative. But that was the first thing. But if we take this back to the new normal that we've been talking about the last couple of weeks here on the show, back in 2008, we can say we started the new normal after the Depression. Remember that President Barack Obama ran on hope and change. People wanted change. Well, they got some change, but a lot of people are upset with the changes. And that's why we're having a push for change in the other direction, because Donald Trump ran on the idea of change, but this is a different type of change, just as Senator Bernie Sanders' change would have been something different. So, you know, it recalls the Fourth Turning by Strauss and Howe, because they describe very much this type of a situation where people keep throwing one group of rascals out to put another group of rascals in. As they talk about politicians, I think it was H.G. Wells that referred to it like that. And everybody wants change, and they're frustrated. And that's where you either get positive change or where you get no change or negative change, which just makes things worse.
But it's obvious, you know, when you had Obama coming in and he ran on hope and change. And remember, we were going through, number one, the U.S. economy was in a recession. Two, we were in probably the biggest financial crisis since the Great Depression. There were layoffs. The unemployment rate got over 10%, something that we hadn't seen since probably 1981. So there were a lot of things that were wrong with the country. And the country was willing to say, look, put somebody new in. We don't want another Republican. Fix this. And very similar to 8 years ago, what happened? Barack Obama came in. Not only did he win the election, but he also, the Democrats took over both houses of Congress. They controlled the Senate. They controlled the House. Fast forward 8 years. Now, Trump has become president, and also the Republicans control both houses. And so, look for, at least I think you're going to see, as we head into 2017, you're going to see a lot of legislation that has been held back because of divided Congress and a Democratic president. You're going to see a lot of legislation go through. But one of the things that really strikes me, and something that was not covered in this political campaign, and mark my words, it'll be my prediction, that as soon as Trump assumes office, watch how the media starts to cover the economy. Because as we've been pointing out here on the show over the last 3 or 4 months, we've seen economic growth slow down into the 1% range, which has caused the Fed to hold back on raising interest rates. Now, it's widely expected that they're going to raise interest rates in December, but the feeling is if they do, it's one and done, because a lot of the things that we have seen is a weakening economy. Now, here's the question. Can that be reversed by President-elect Trump when he gets into office by legislation? Because a lot of times the markets move on sentiment. They move on hope with the anticipation that certain things are going to be done. Regulations rescinded, lower taxes, Obamacare repealed, the Keystone Pipeline finally approved. So the markets can move in the opposite direction, because typically you do not see Congress and the president move on meaningful legislation unless the country is in a crisis or in a recession. And that's what Obama had when he came into office in 2009, and he was able to get his stimulus package passed immediately within the first 100 days of office. So a lot of people are saying, what is going to happen within the first 100 days of office? And one of the issues, I'm sure he will have some very smart economic advisors that will say, look, Mr. President, we've got some things that are deteriorating in the economy, and we need to move here, because if we don't, we could end up in a recession. And you know, John, if we're in a recession, that's all the media is going to talk about.
We need to look at what President-elect Trump is going to face. There's obvious economic issues. It would seem the military issues might war against the economic ones. It depends on how much of a pie Washington can cut up anymore, given where we are, $20 trillion in debts, where we'll be when we start his administration, and the deficit growing. So let's talk about the challenges facing him.
Well, number one is the economy, because as we've seen, economic growth rates this year will be less than 2%. As we contend here, the economy, at least from an economic perspective, peaked in the summer of 2015. So whether he can move expeditiously, which I think he can, to ward off a recession, that would be remarkable. So number one is the economy. The second thing that he is going to face, and the Wall Street Journal did an article called Obama's Fiscal Legacy, and the one thing that the president is leaving, the new president-elect, is a large and growing federal budget. And there's going to be a fiscal issue that's going to arise, because President Obama's luck, fiscal luck, has finally run out. And one of the things that we have seen is the government's fiscal year ends on September 30th, but the deficit for 2016 increased by $148 billion to $587 billion. That's 3.2% of GDP versus 2.5%, roughly a $400 billion deficit the year before. And that's despite falling defense spending, which has reduced military deployments overseas, and flat Pentagon outlays. And the other thing that was remarkable, and this is something that the Republican Congress and the president are going to have to face, and this is why I think they're going to move on Obamacare. Social Security, Medicare, and Medicaid spending went up by $75 billion in 2016, or 4.2%. Spending on Social Security, Medicare, and Medicaid now represent 10% of the entire U.S. economy, its highest level ever, and it continues to rise because you have 68% of the government spending is now on automatic pilot. That is Social Security, Medicare, Medicaid, and interest on the debt. And here's the question. We've already seen it rise in the bond market. Yields on treasuries are rising. And the CBO just published a report that said that if interest rates were to rise by nearly 1%, given the maturity levels of U.S. debt, that would be an increase of interest on the debt by $160 billion a year. And so the CBO is basically saying that spending has climbed by nearly 40% in the last 3 years alone, or $368 billion in 2016. And that doesn't include the states that are obliged to chip in. The other issue the government is facing, and this tells you more about some of the economic issues we've been discussing here on the program. Individual income tax receipts for 2016 were flat, showing declining incomes. Corporate income taxes fell by $44 billion. Is our 13% as business profits have sagged, and this goes in line with what we've been reporting, with a peak in corporate profits going back to the summer of 2014. So basically, federal outlays are now almost 21% of GDP compared to 20% in 2014.
Well, it would seem like we've got at least two principal issues here. Number one, you have growing entitlements, and that's going to keep on going, especially in the area of Social Security, raising the cost for business, growing government spending, but anemic economic growth. So you're going to have to do something to get the economic growth going to fuel some of these other agendas. And that's where I see the conflict coming in, because obviously the way to do it, I think Jim Rickards was talking about that. It was the idea that we have to stimulate small business, not the Fortune 500, but the small businesses are the ones that create the jobs. So in order to get the economy going, you have to encourage them to hire people.
Well, there's three issues that if you read the analysis that's been done for a lot of people that are following what's going on in the Trump campaign, there are three issues they're going to have to address. Because we know, for example, one of the issues that came up in the last couple of weeks of the campaign was the 25% increase in healthcare premiums as a result of Obamacare. Arizona has 116% increase. Many of the states have double-digit increases. This is going to bankrupt the system. And as we've talked here on the program, there's three things that are going to happen with Obamacare. Either one, it would collapse of its own weight. Number two, they'd put a Band-Aid on it, depending whether Secretary of State Hillary Clinton won. Or number three, they're going to redo it. But it's not going to be that easy to redo it because there's a lot of things that have gotten embedded into the healthcare system. Because they're going to have to tread very lightly here because there's almost 21 million people that are on Obamacare. Most of them are mainly sick people. What are you going to do with these 21 million people? So they're going to have to deal with that. But one of the first issues they're going to deal with is Obamacare. And if they get rid of it and work on a new system, that might alleviate some of the cost pressures that we're seeing coming in with healthcare. Because what happens if it didn't get repealed in next year? Anybody that comes into the system is going to see a 25% increase in their premiums. Or if you don't have Obamacare, next April, you're going to have to come up with $700 if you're a single individual and you don't have health care. What is that going to do to spending next year? Or if you're a family of four, you're going to have to come up with $2,300 when you file your tax return. Also, a lot of businesses have gone more towards part-time employment and reduced work hours to under 30 hours, so they don't have to meet these health care mandates through Obamacare. So that's one thing that's going to be addressed. Number two, they have a tax plan, and they want to reduce taxes and regulations on business. There seems to be agreement on that. Number three, one of the issues that they're going to have to deal with is declining military spending in a military that has much of its equipment in disrepair. I live in San Diego. That's home to four carrier battle groups, a Navy SEAL base, a Marine base, and also a submarine base. And I know when the carriers come into town, there have been local news stories how they're cannibalizing equipment on different planes so they can get parts for these planes. So military spending is going to be on the agenda. And then a fourth agenda, and you're seeing this reflected in some of the stocks that we see taking off on Wall Street, is infrastructure spending. I don't care if it's roads, bridges, airports. The Society of Engineers gives the U.S. infrastructure system a D-. So there's widespread agreement between the Republicans and Democrats on infrastructure spending. I think that will probably get approved, and they will have to negotiate because they're going to have to increase defense spending, especially with the geopolitical risk. Number three, they're going to have to get rid of Obamacare, and they're going to have to get economic growth rates back to the 3% or more level, because you cannot grow an economy and afford to spend for the entitlements the way we are with an economy that is growing at 1% a year. You need economic growth at 3-4%, and God forbid if we go into recession and nothing is done. So if you take a look at what is likely to come about in the first 100 days, expect some kind of repeal of Obamacare with some kind of compromise to take care of those who are already on it, especially since most of them are sick or ill. Number two, some kind of tax reform that lowers tax rates. Three, increase in defense spending. Number four, increase in infrastructure spending. And one of the things I think the bond market is reflecting already, and it's reflected in the stock market, you've got rising stock prices, but you have rising bond yields, because this will be inflationary. Because anytime the government spends money, puts it into the economy, but what you hope in exchange for that is to get higher economic growth.
It would seem that there is a geopolitical risk in here as well, tangled right in with it. So what are the implications of that?
Well, I mean, John, any new president that comes into office, one of the first things that happens is the enemies will test him. And I suspect it's going to be no different with Donald Trump. Well, how will he react to Russian or Chinese provocations? And or he has said that if I'm elected, he's going to dispense with ISIS. What will he do with another ISIS attack somewhere? And you know it's going to come because they're in 38 countries right now. So the geopolitical risk, I don't care if it's ISIS, if it's Syria, the Middle East, or provocations by China and Russia, I suspect, John, they're going to try to test him and see the mettle of the man. What will the U.S. do? How will it respond? Because right now, it's been very passive. And if you're aggressor, I suspect in the remaining days, 71 days until President-elect Trump takes office, that some kind of provocation or some kind of movement, you would see that take place here in the next 71 days. So there's a lot of anticipation. There's a lot of uncertainty, and you're seeing this reflected in the makeup of what's going on in the stock market. Anytime there's a change in presidential leadership in either party, you have rotations take place in the stock market, and that's what you're seeing right now. You're seeing industrial stocks do well. You're seeing gold prices fall with the anticipation the Fed will raise interest rates in December. But, you know, the next president is going to need all the help he gets. At least now he will have control of both parties of Congress, very much like Barack Obama did in 2008. But I would say if you look on the legislative front, four things to expect: repeal of Obamacare, tax cuts, they've been in the waiting, they just haven't been approved. Expect infrastructure spending, an increase in defense spending, and a reduction in regulations in a lot of the executive orders that were put in place by President Obama to end run Congress. President-elect Trump has promised to use his own executive orders to repeal them.
You know, the Iran deal was one of those. It's a really actually a treaty, but it was never posed as a treaty. We give it a different name. And so it didn't have to be ratified by the Senate, which is what the Constitution requires. That might get repealed as well. And that changes the whole geopolitical structure.
It will. So I guess we're going to get a glimpse of what we might expect. I was watching some of the analysis on the news last night, and I guess he's got to appoint 4,500 positions. This not only includes his own cabinet of advisors, but, you know, the heads of various government departments, Department of Justice, Department of State. So there are going to be a lot of appointments as the markets wait to see. He's got an advisory transition team in place. And I think a lot of people are going to sort of look at who he appoints as his advisors to get a clue in terms of what direction the Trump administration will be heading.
You know, there are a whole series of issues in this election. There are all different facets to it. One of the interesting things is that fourth turning idea again, that there comes a point where people recognize that a lot of reform is required. And there are a lot of people, there's a giant undercurrent in the country that are very upset with the way things have gone. Remember that people tend to vote their jobs, their medical expenses, and their cost of living when they go to the polls. That tends to be largely what they vote. That sense that things are wrong, that they're out of control, that Washington needs reform, that it's corrupt, and that everybody's lying to them all the time. And also denigrating them for what they believe about certain issues. Rather than rational debate, they're being called a whole string of dirty names. And they're tired of that. And I think that contributed in large part to the election. But it's a terrific undercurrent because it's that group of people looking to see what comes out of this whole thing.
Well, it's not just that group. It's also the group on the other side. And we've seen this reflected in some of the protests in Portland, in some of the violence in other cities. So there's also an anarchist movement that is up in this country as well. So it's going to be interesting in terms of the things that we've seen with the Black Lives Matter group, some of the, you know, the shooting of police officers, law and order. So there are a lot of issues, social issues that are up here. And it's going to be interesting because the country is divided in many ways. You have a move towards socialism on part of the population, and you have a move towards the other direction and say, look, get government out of my life. Taxes, heavy burdens of regulation, there's a movement there. So it's going to be interesting to see if President-elect Trump can bridge the differences between the two sides, because it's clearly a reevaluation that's going on in the country in terms of which direction it wants to go, and also within both political parties. So, you know, if there's one thing that's constant here in this new normal, it is change. And that's what this election is about. It'll be interesting to see as we head into next year is of change is what we get.
Well, and having said that, Jim, I would guess that in the weeks to come, there is going to be no lack of things which need to be discussed because we are in a totally new environment here as Mr. Obama phases out and Mr. Trump phases in, and that will affect the market. So anything on the immediate horizon that you see other than what we have discussed already?
I would say probably the things that we're going to be watching heading into the end of the year. We've got Thanksgiving coming up here and Black Friday, the first day of the Christmas retail season. So, you know, I'm sure the markets are going to want to analyze that. Will consumer spending still hold up and lead the economy going forward? So we'll be watching that. In the month of December, we've got a Fed meeting. Will she or will she not? Right now, the futures market says 70% probability she will. And we're going to want to see what that's going to do to interest rates, because right now we have interest rates that are rising. The 10-year note has jumped above 2% to 2.15. Hard to believe that in the middle of the summer, in June and July of this year, it got down to 1.3. We're already anticipating higher inflation, higher spending, the 10-year note. So we're going to keep an eye on that. And then, of course, we're also going to be keeping an eye on who is going to be the makeup of the next administration. Those are the things that the markets will be focusing on, as we will hear on the program. In the meantime, on behalf of John Loeffler and myself, we'd like to thank you for joining us here on the Financial Sense News Hour. Until you and I talk again, we hope you have a pleasant weekend.
You can subscribe to Financial Sense News Hour in the iTunes and BlackBerry podcast libraries or at feeds.feedburner.com/FSM. Find more information about our guests at www.financialsense.com/newshour. Friend us at www.facebook.com/financialsenseonline. For our on-the-go listeners, you can access Financial Sense on your mobile device at m.financialsense.com. The Financial Sense News Hour is for informational and educational purposes only and should not be considered as a solicitation or offer to purchase or sell any securities. The investments, investment strategies, and investment philosophies discussed or presented on the News Hour each involve their own unique risk factors, which are not discussed on the show. Responses to listener inquiries are based on the personal opinions of James Poplava and do not take into account listeners' suitability, objectives, or risk tolerance. Financial Sense News Hour and its parent company shall not be liable for any financial losses that result from investing in any companies profiled on or advertising with Financial Sense, or arising out of the use of any material on the News Hour. Be advised that you invest at your own risk.